Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And this morning we're digging back into The Mark Steiner Show archives to listen to an interview I did with Arthur Magida at the Enoch Pratt Library in 2012. We discussed his book, The Nazi Seance, the strange story of the Jewish psychic in Hitler's circle. Enjoy. All right, welcome. Good to have you back, man.
Thank you, Mark. It's always fun to be with you.
So, you always have the knack for finding the obscure and turning it into a book that hopefully is not so obscure once you write it.
No, I don't want this one to be obscure at all. And yes, I have no idea how I developed this knack, but thank you for appreciating it. This one, like so many of the others you just mentioned, Mark, sort of popped out of the blue. I was over at the now lamented Daedalus Books, Belvedere Square.
I'm so sorry that closed.
Yeah, that was a wonderful store, and I had so much fun browsing around, which indeed is what I was doing one day, and I found a book called The Rise of the Indian Rope Trick. And I've always been interested in India and mysticism and magic and rope, so I picked it up. I was reading it about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Smack in the middle of the book were about 2 or 3 paragraphs, some guy's ideas about how the Indian rope trick was done. They seem kind of plausible, but the identification for this guy was not plausible. The author identified this fellow, Erik Jan Hannesson, as Hitler's Jewish clairvoyant. 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, I did not need any coffee to keep me awake. That jolted me, and I thought, that will be a book. And here we are.
And you discovered him.
And I discovered Hannesson, yeah.
And in fact, he was at some level a clairvoyant for the Nazis, if not for Hitler himself.
He was very much a clairvoyant for the Nazis. Whether he was a clairvoyant for Hitler himself is still questionable and debatable, but there is no doubt that he was very much in the Nazis' pocket, and he was very much an ally and a cheerleader for the Nazis.
And you also have some more part of this book we'll get to later where you list a bunch of Jews who were pro-Hitler and Jews for the National – what was it called? Jews for the National
– League of Nationalist Jews.
League of Nationalist Jews.
Right. Yes.
But and that, going back to this, so here we have the story of Erik Jan Hannesson.
Yes.
Right? His real name is Hermann Steinschneider.
Nice Jewish boy.
So his sojourn, this is fascinating to me. I mean, because these things happen a lot in history where these contradictions erupt. Somebody who would be the complete antithesis of a world as he meant, you know, and here this was. I mean, so here's a guy who starts out as a kid of a dysfunctional family. In Austria. Well, tell it.
Yes, he was. He did come out of it. Very, very dysfunctional and very, very impoverished family. Hermann Steinschneider, eventually Erik Jan Hannesson, was born in Vienna, 1889. His parents barely had a cent. They were itinerant performers. Hannesson's mother died when he was about 9 or 10. He and his father then moved off to some small town. It didn't seem to be much of a way that the father could earn a living anyway in Vienna. And Hannesson, you mentioned my knack. Hannesson had a knack of his own, and that was for always getting in trouble. He caused a large fire.
The fire.
Actually, fire kind of permeates this entire book. Although I don't get to the Nazis burning books, that comes later in history. But yes, he did cause a fire in that town. He was reading as a young youth about Nero playing his fiddle while Rome was burning. He thought he would have some fun in the town of Gorlice, and he started a fire. Supposedly, a barn was burning. A robber who was notorious came running out, and so did his girlfriend, who was the daughter of a tailor in town. So he thought there would be a happy ending to this debacle. He he was scolded by his teacher. He got a fraction of the reward that was being offered for the robber. And one of the lessons for young Hannesson was that you just cannot trust authority. They promised a reward. They're giving him a small fraction. Shame on them. But this was such a fascinating kid and such a rebellious kid and such a headstrong kid. You know, back in Vienna after his father remarried, he wrote in his autobiography years later that he was having an affair with a 45-year-old singer. He could watch her perform from the window in his apartment. He and the performer wanted to run away. He was about 14 years old. They had no money. So back to my rope, and not the Indian rope trick in this case. One by one, he started to lower the furniture from the apartment down to his waiting lover. They wanted to pawn all this. His father came home just as Hannesson himself was halfway down the rope. And he says, you know, come back up here, Herman, and go to your room. And that was the end of that adventure. And shortly after that, he ran away from home for good.
For good.
Yes.
But you know, like that story and like a lot of the other stories he told as you write in his autobiography and this story about what might have really or not really happened when he burned this barn down, whether the guy who ran away was somebody who actually existed or was, lived in 1818 way before he was even born.
Right, yes. I mean,
so he had this penchant for creating worlds that didn't exist.
Yes. And that was one of his great strengths and in the end one of his great weaknesses. You know, he had a hyperactive imagination. He also had a very, very strong personality. And as you said, he would create worlds that didn't exist. This business about the robber sounds plausible almost when you read his autobiography. But I did some research on the robber himself. And as you said, there was one in this vicinity, but decades before Hannesson was living there. So he had a way of weaving strands and bits and pieces of history and fact and factoids and mythology. And in the end, he created his own mythology, about himself.
Now, one of he, though, did have a knack for this. I mean, and he was able to create this persona that was a psychic that could was clairvoyant and became a multimillionaire because of it.
Yeah.
Or not multimillionaire, he became very wealthy.
He became extremely wealthy. And most likely in terms of our currency today, he was certainly a lower level. He was one of the 1%, let's say.
He's one of the 1%. Look, I'm about to want to read something here. You have something that's open there?
Sure, yeah. You know, we're talking about this man being a clairvoyant. He supposedly, if we're to believe anything that's ever been written about him, either by himself or by others and people who knew him over the years, around about 1914, 1915, he met a man in Vienna who was very adept at, quote, reading minds. What in the magic trade, though, is known as muscle reading, and a whole chapter in this book is devoted to the art of muscle reading. But over the years, he became quite famous. He became quite wealthy. About 31, 32, early 33, he was very close with the Nazis. One of the great ironies of this book is that here's a man who had, by his own accord, significant psychic clairvoyant abilities, and yet, what he did not understand, and here I will read from the book, he did not understand that the Nazis knew that Germans were desperate for a Messiah who would redeem them. Just 1 month after the Nazis would take power in 1933, a Protestant pastor in Berlin rhapsodized that Hitler was, quote, a completely pure man. Such a clear, truthful man does not derive from the earth, but out of that higher world that Christ called the kingdom of heaven. Hitler came from heaven. He was delivered to Germans by God. If Hannesson was really a clairvoyant, I write, he would have known that every night in a few years, children in Nazi-run orphanages would praise Hitler as the source of everything good. Every night, these orphans would pray, and this I find chilling every time I read it. Leader, my leader, given to me by God, you have rescued Germany out of deepest misery. To you, I owe my daily bread. Leader, my leader, my belief, my light. Leader, my leader, do not abandon me. But the great clairvoyant, Mr. Hanussen, knew none of this. He certainly didn't know that the Nazis dreamed of planting their own paradise here on Earth, small, gray, dismal, an Eden with watchtowers and barbed wire, fascist golems along the Danube and the Rhine and the Seine. Hanussen read minds. He told fortunes. This was a clever scheme for rough times. But when men are playing God, the stakes are high, and the game extends beyond the reach of mere mortals. Hanussen was mortal. The Nazis thought they were eternal, and with 1,000 years at their disposal, they pretended they were as close to eternity as mere men could get.
And there in all of that lies the horror and the contradictions of it all that you write about, I think.
Yes, very much. The horror because this man, Hanussen, had no idea what lay ahead. The contradiction because, one, obviously he's Jewish. Two, he is assisting these men who would be some of the greatest savages, commit some of the worst acts of genocide in all of human history. If he was really a clairvoyant, he would have known what was looming. If he was really a more decent person, he would not have allied himself and turned his astrological newspapers, which had a circulation of almost 1 million in the middle of 1932, basically into Nazis' rags. He had swastikas in the two top front corners of these papers. He would have photos on the front page of these papers of Hitler looking benign and virile and friendly, if you can imagine a friendly Hitler. He would make great predictions about how well Hitler and all the other Nazis were going to do in the elections, and there were many elections won after another after another. If he was really a good man and if he was an honest man and he didn't constantly portray himself as being a psychic, a clairvoyant, he would not have loaned so much money to Count Heldorf, who was the head of the stormtroopers in Berlin. He would not have outfitted the stormtroopers themselves, who were quite broke by the middle of 1932. He would not have loaned them his car. He had a small fleet of limos. This was a man who was trying to play both sides of the fence. He was trying to maintain his fame, his wealth, and cozy up to the Nazis. And I think in the end, especially on the night of March 24th, 1933, when he met a very brutal end, at that point he knew that he had really been overextending himself. You don't do that.
To say the least. But one of the things, though, that what you just said, that this man, Erich John Hanussen, Steinschneider is his real name, Steinschneider, was that there was almost as naivete about him for me.
Yes.
That he saw was his ability to hustle and make a lot of money and sleep with a lot of women, and whatever got him there was fine with him. It was like, you know, it was like the slave who would give up the rebellion in the South. It was like the Jew cuddling up to the Nazis. It was like he didn't, because it was only about what he needed.
Exactly. Yes.
He was abandoning his daughter. All of it. Schmendrick.
Are we going to need subtitles for this interview, Mark? I mean, Hanussen had great drive. He had great ambition. And I assume you're implying it's bad that he slept with so many women, Mark. I'm not sure what side of the moral fence you're coming down on.
No. What I'm saying is that he was a character who was obviously an incredible character.
Yes.
Who would have been fascinating to watch, to research and read about, to interview even maybe, to play on the stage because of this cat would be a fascinating person for an actor to play. You know?
But yes.
He was really amoral. He had no sense of ethic.
He had no sense of ethic because all he had was a vague sense of self. The whole world was Hanneson writ large. Anything that would advance Hanneson was fine with Mr. Hanneson. In a sense, he was one of the ultimate narcissists of the last century. Anybody who would say to an SS captain in Berlin in early 33, just as the Nazis were on the verge of assuming power, Adolf looks more like an unemployed hairdresser than a Caesar, you know, has no sense of the historical characters he's dealing with. You do not tell a very powerful Nazi that that man's Führer looks like an unemployed hairdresser. So for Hanneson, the world was nothing more than a series of opportunities to advance himself. This was a man who predicted in his paper, which I just spoke about, cosmic laws determine the decision for Hitler. He prophesied in the paper, the world will not become Bolshevist, it will become fascist. Hanneson had only one goal in life, and that was to be successful, to have great wealth, to have audiences fawn over him, and to a very, very large degree, that did happen for a considerable extent of his career. But one of the people I interviewed for this book, you were just talking about how much fun it would have been to interview Hanneson, mm-hmm. and that would have been a blast, and perhaps we can have a small seance of our own right here in the
studio. Conjure him up.
Actually, I did have a seance while I was working on this book. I'll mention that in a moment. But one of the people I did interview who is alive is Teller of Penn and Teller. Now, have you seen him on the stage?
Yeah, a long time ago.
Right. And there are the two members of that team. There's the big, tall, bombastic fellow who never shuts up and annoys a lot of people, Penn. And there's the shorter fellow, much more diminutive and always silent on stage. But he spoke to me. And I really wish that he's the one who spoke on stage because he's extremely smart and very, very articulate. He mentioned the ethos that a really good magician or mind leader would adhere to. He said, a magician puts a frame of truth around his lies that prevents them from doing harm, a frame of truth. And that is what Hanneson never recognized. He never understood that he could perform on stage and with a wink and a nod to his audience, let them know that he was putting them on, that all this was just a trick and a sham. But as his career succeeded, and especially by the late 1920s, I think he really believed that he had psychic powers. There's another great quote I have from a magician, a guy named Carl Germain. He said, conjuring is the only absolutely honest profession. The conjurer promises to deceive, and he does. Well, Hanneson's promise to his audience was that he was not deceiving them, that he was the real article.
But there was something in that period where people wanted that, and as there is now on some levels in this 21st century, in this period of time we're living in, people want to believe this exists. They wanted to believe that he could go to an audience and say, yell out a date, and I'll tell you what happened that day.
Right.
You know, that they wanted to believe that this was real.
Right. And especially, you're right, especially in that era, in this interwar era between World War I, World War II, and even more in Germany, which was so devastated by the Versailles Treaty, that was so devastated by the war itself.
By World War One.
By World War One, right. Yeah, because the book ends really in 1933. But this was a city that was attracting maybe 10,000, 20,000 psychics. They were all flocking there from around the continent. At the same time, this was a city that had great intellectual and artistic ferment, which is what I knew about Berlin. I didn't know anything about psychics and the occult. That opened up a whole different window for me with Berlin between the wars. I also didn't know that this was a city, because of the great impoverishment, had 100,000 whores walking the street, had about 34,000 maimed veterans from the First War begging in the streets, that had teenage daughters prostituting themselves with their parents' permission after school because that's the only way they could get by. Billy Wilder was making great films and Bertolt Brecht was writing great plays, but there's this whole other Berlin, not the Berlin of Hanneson, but the Berlin of, let's say, the real people, the people who would never even be able to afford to see Hanneson. So we had many aspects of the city all coexisting at the same time. And that was one of the reasons why it was such a great crucible for the political parties of that time, the communists, the socialists, the Nazis. You know, they could all prey upon the poverty and the hopelessness. And to a very large extent, it was that hopelessness that drove so many people, rich and poor, to consult with some of the psychics that were doing quite well in Berlin.
And Hanneson began to make this huge name for himself. He had these breakthroughs that allowed him to get on stage and get this following that gave him millions of dollars and a platform.
Right. And then the choice for Hanneson became what to do with that platform. Would he use that for good? Would he use that for bad? Mr. clairvoyant, and I use that term very loosely, didn't anticipate that the socialists and the communists would be quite upset that he was an ally of Count Helldorff.
Well, the Count Helldorff thing.
Yes.
The world he had that we were stuck between Albert Hellwig and Count Wolf Heinrich von Helldorff.
Well done, Mark.
the Nazi leader in yes. Berlin of the thugs, the SS. Mm. I mean, that to me is this a huge piece of the story of his on one hand and his naivety on his complete myopic selfishness.
Yes.
On being, you know, that aligning and paying all the bills for this Nazi count, who also protected him.
Right.
I mean, it was an insane, brief, intense period.
Yes.
In Germany, and for this Erich John Hanneson, Hermann Steinschneider.
I'm glad you're having such a wonderful time with his name, Mark. But I will warn you, he may be watching us at this very moment. Yes, you mentioned Hellwig, who was a judge in Potsdam, who about 1929 or so began a very concerted campaign against not only Hanneson but any clairvoyants who were holding these private consultations. He thought these people were leading the citizens of Germany astray.
Because this guy Hanneson already talked to listeners that he already had a trial previous to that. Where he almost went to jail in Czechoslovakia.
Right, and that trial actually was one of the great stepping stones for Hanneson to even greater success. This trial went on for about 4 or 5 months. He was accused of being a fraud. He kept begging the judge to perform in court. Finally, in May 1933, the judge says, yes, you may. Hanneson does all these feats of mind reading, muscle reading, whatever you wish to call it. He is completely vindicated. The judge says he is the real thing. Even a headline in the New York Times, 6,000 miles away, says clairvoyant proves power in Czech court. Jan Hanneson demonstrates while experts wrangle. So all these people were wrangling. Hanneson got off scot-free. Then he moves to Berlin. Hellwig, this judge, is after him. He thinks he's a fraud no matter what happened in Czechoslovakia. Street fights are going on between the left-wingers and the Nazis. Hanneson is a little bit perturbed about that. He wants a little bit of security and safety. He starts coddling up to Helldorff, the head of the stormtroopers. Basically, they had a quid pro. Yes, Hanneson, I will provide a certain degree of security for you, but you really have to bail me out. I'm always in debt. Helldorff loved to gamble. Hanneson had a lot of money. He would loan Helldorff funds. In exchange, he got many, many signed IOUs from him, which he kept in a safe. And eventually, that was part of Hanneson's undoing as well. So this man who was the clairvoyant kept creating opportunities for his enemies to finally do him in.
And so Hellwig was hell-bent on destroying Hanussen.
Yes, Helvig. Oh, my. Helvig was hellbent. The socialist communist middle of 32 were hellbent also. They saw Hanussen as one of the weaknesses, one of the Achilles' heels of the Nazis. They knew this guy was really cozy with the Nazis, especially with Helldorf, the head of the stormtroopers. They thought if they could knock Hanussen off his pedestal, perhaps then the Nazis would topple as well. So they began in their own newspapers a campaign against Hanussen. Finally, December 32, they have headlines announcing
he's a Jew.
He's a Jew. Shame on this man. Not only that, they also had a letter from a rabbi who had officiated at one of Hanussen's weddings. So this man is certifiably Jewish.
And what struck me about this was, given the intense political time that existed in Germany in the late 20s and early 30s, and when that happens, and especially if – it made me think of some stuff I've read that happened in the 60s here and even in the 30s here in America, where – if you were fighting to end segregation in the South, you were fighting to end the racism in this country, and somebody was kind of using whatever skills they had to cozy up to white folks in the world and the white power structure, that it almost behooved the other side to expose that person and say, you know, we're going to expose you as who you are. You're going to expose you as a Jew cuddling up to the Nazis.
Right.
And I understand exactly what they were doing. They had to, though I think sometimes from reading your book that the communists and socialists thought he had more power than he did.
Yes. They thought he had more power, more influence. Hanussen thought he had more power, more influence. One of the real – there were so many eye-openers for me when immersing myself in this period. One of them was that, you know, Hanussen was not the only Jew who was cozy with the Nazis. You know, I kept thinking as I began this book, well, certainly he wasn't the only one who was deluded. There were other Jews, a banker in the city of Freiburg.
Yes.
Who was quite friendly with the Nazis, who thought they meant good, who was one of their early economic advisors shortly after.
Max Naumann.
The very man himself.
The Jewish banker, right?
Right. They named him an honorary Aryan. A lot of good that did him in the end. and there were the members of the League of Nationalist Jews, basically a middle-class group, very, very assimilationist.
But this is a great line you have from Naomi. He said,
yes.
the Jewish banker who loved the Nazis. We reject Yahweh, the old tribal god of the Asiatic nomadic horde. We have a German god.
Yes, we have a German god. He could have been wearing a brown shirt himself. We have a German guard. We have all these mythologies that the Nazis also were creating or tapping into that were part of German consciousness. So there were these Jews, very assimilationist, who just cared about accommodating themselves to Germany. There was this banker who just cared about putting Germany on a stable financial footing, who also believed to some extent that, you know, the Nazis, well, maybe I have some concerns about them, but they're just going to be an interim measure. Once we find ourselves stable, then we will return to some facet of democracy. And actually, that was one of Hanussen's predictions as well, going back to late 32. He said, well, Hitler may be stern, but we will only have to endure him for maybe 3, 4, 5 years. We'll have a stable, strong Germany, and then we'll have another democracy. Well, Hanussen nor many Germans did not live to see that stable democracy.
You're listening to my interview with Art Megidda, author of The Nazi Seance, the strange story of a Jewish psychic in Hitler's circle. Comes out of the Mark Steiner Show archives from 2012. There's more of this conversation when we come back, so stay right here. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Mark Steiner. And this morning, we're listening back to my interview with Arthur Magida, author of The Nazi Seance, The Strange Story of the Jewish Psychic in Hitler's Circle. From the Mark Steiner Show archives in 2012. And here's the rest of that conversation and story.
And Art, one of the things that is part of this book that I want to kind of grab a hold of for, we didn't do it just yet, which is his relationship with Hitler. Because this is, because in some ways, you have the title here, The Jewish Psychic in Hitler's Circle. Other people have called him Hitler's Psychic. But what his actual relationship was with Hitler is actually still not really known.
It's not really known. I mean, in the book, I talk about the strong probability of Hanussen conferring with Hitler late 32, early 33, in the cafe at the very snazzy Kaiserhof Hotel in Berlin. I got those stories from contemporary accounts, from some of Hanussen's associates, from some journalists. People did see them conferring. Most likely, and here's where I go out a bit on a limb, but I've done this before in my life. Most likely, Hanussen was telling Hitler everything he had been saying in his newspaper about this man. The stars are aligned in your favor. You will become chancellor. We're all rooting for you. You mean good for Germany. But yes, the subtitle is The Strange Story of the Jewish Psychic in Hitler's Circle. Up front on the cover, I could not say the Jewish psychic who sat down with Hitler, the Jewish psychic who had seances for Hitler. He did have seances with other Nazis. There certainly were other Nazis than Hitler who had great faith in seances and in astrology and in other aspects of the occult. For years, I've been hearing stories about how dedicated Hitler was to the occult. I refute a number of those in my book. I think many of those are nonsense. A lot of what you find on the internet or in certain other books about Hitler and the occult, pure gibberish, disregard them. But I do believe, and this I got from certain impeccable sources, that Hitler did have a little quirk of his own, and that he really believed in the power of hands to discern somebody's character. He would look at somebody's hands, and if they didn't have the right shape, if the cuticles were too long, if the nails were the wrong shape, if he would shake the hand of a new ambassador or a general from another country, he might have a conversation with him. And then shortly after that, he would leave the room, and the potentate would not understand why, because apparently he had been having such a fine conversation with Hitler before. Eventually, this man would learn Hitler did not like the shape or the feel of this man's hands. So Hitler relying on astrological charts, no. Hitler having some conversations with Hanussen, yes. And Hitler having his own quirks, certainly.
Well, he did have quirks. I mean, as you write in the book, he'd always said that Jesus was only half Jewish because his father wasn't Jewish. His father was God.
So, right. Yes.
But it's also important, I think, again, to reiterate about Erich John Hanussen, who was passing as a Dane. I mean, it wasn't just that he was just Jewish and not talking about it. He was clearly saying, I'm somebody else.
Right, yes. And he did not go under the name of Steinschneider since 1918, 1919, when he adopted the name Hanussen for stage purposes. But yes, he was very much not acknowledging that he was a Jew. Yet what is peculiar, despite not acknowledging that he was Jewish, despite having little connection with the Jewish community, no matter where he was living, is that he insisted that his three wives who were not Jewish originally, convert to Judaism, that each of them have a Jewish wedding with him. So he felt some sort of connection and alliance with the Jewish community, even though he was very estranged from it.
So you spent a lot of time back and forth to Europe. You met his daughter.
Yes, I met Erica, who lives in northern Italy, who was 90 years old when I met her. Absolutely charming, absolutely obsessed, I suppose a kinder word would be dedicated, to her father. She lives in a nursing home. She has pictures on every wall of her father, and we spent 4 or 5 days talking about him. What was very sad about meeting Erica is that, you know, she was born in 1920. Her parents divorced about 1924. She did not see her father from around 24 to late 32 when he visited her and her mother in northern Italy. And yet...
And wrote this letter in 1932 that he would see her that summer on the boat, but of course he did not.
Exactly. He wrote her a letter saying, you will come on my yacht. He was so wealthy he had his own yacht. We will have a wonderful cruise this coming summer, and as I say in the book, there would be no summer for Erik Jan Hannesson. One of the reasons he went down to Murano in northern Italy was to persuade his second wife to run away to America with him. He knew that the dragnet was getting closer in Berlin, and he wasn't quite a safe man there anymore. But when he made his entreaties to Therese, the second wife, who was in the middle of a very happy marriage, she just laughed. She knew this man's character, and she said, "Oh, Hannesson, you always want the other man's wife." And I got that from Erica, the daughter, during one of these interviews, and I just cracked up when that was translated for me. She speaks German. I had my translator with me. But I would say it was maybe the second or third day of interview with Erica that she told me that she had been in touch with her father. She believes she has clairvoyant abilities just like her father does, and they're always in psychic communion with each other. It was reassuring in some ways to know that Hannesson fully approved of my project, that I had his blessings, and that I had his protection no matter where I went. And when my translator and I left the nursing home and I started driving down these narrow, curving streets in Murano, she and I just cracked up. And I said, "Oh, yes, Hannesson's watching over us. We have his protection." That was the only time, Mark, that my Fiat went over the curb on this entire 2000.
See? See?
So, Hannesson, if you are listening to me now, I am not scoffing any longer, nor have I gone over any curbs.
But you spent a lot of time in Europe for this book. You spent time in Berlin, a city. You had not been there before, right?
I had not been in Berlin. I had not been in Germany. I made 3 trips to Germany for this book. I had not wanted to go to Germany, because, quite frankly, I was afraid to go to Germany. I mean, horrible things we know happened in Germany. Horrible things we know were engineered by Germans. I did not want to be on the soil that had nurtured these people. For the book, I felt compelled to go there to do an honest and credible book. The first trip was about 2.5 years ago. I was still quite nervous. My first full day in Berlin, I remember it was a Friday. I was meeting with my translator in her apartment till about 3 in the afternoon. And then I finally say, "Erica, you know, there's a whole city out there I want to see. I hear it's wonderful. I want to go for a walk." And I left her apartment building. There was a steep hill outside. I walked to the top. There was a lovely old church at the crest of this hill. I walked up the cobblestone path. There was a big bulletin board outside, all kinds of notices. I didn't understand a word because I do not understand German. I finally looked at the building itself, and there was a large plaque. Many words on it. I could understand 2 of them. Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
The famous German theologian who stood up to Hitler.
Exactly. And right. This was his church. And here I am, somebody who has...
Whom Martin Luther King loved.
Right. King loved him.
Right.
You know, a man who was very instrumental in peaceful, sensible resistance to Hitler, and a man who, you said, you know, inspired Martin Luther King. And here I am in Germany, a place I've never wanted to be, and I'm standing on what I consider to be holy turf. And I literally started shaking. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, yes, bad things happened here, but good people like Dietrich Bonhoeffer did their best to resist them. And then I went back to my translator's apartment. We had a fine dinner. And then at my instigation, because I love to instigate things, we went off to see a show I always wanted to see. And darn it, I missed it in New York and Broadway. I saw The Producers.
That's great. That's great. You saw The Producers in German. Of course, The Producers was this great piece that was about Hitler. I mean, some people don't know the movie or the play.
Yes, it started out as, you know, Mark, a great film by Mel Brooks, and it takes on Hitler, and there's a wonderful song in the middle of the show, "Springtime for Hitler," which I'm not even going to attempt to sing now.
Why not?
Because your listeners would
turn
off the radio. I don't know what's on a competing station, but they would go to that.
Nothing worth listening to.
Yeah, but what was wonderful was seeing this audience in Berlin laugh at Hitler. What was scary was that I was sitting on the first tier of the balcony. Just behind me was the box where Hitler would sit when he came to this very theater during the war. Not to have people ridicule him from the stage.
Did they tell you that when you were sitting in your box?
No, actually, I had done some research about this show and where it was being presented, so I knew that before I went to Germany.
So I know this book started when you found this one passage in a book about the rope trick, the
Rise of the Indian Rope Trick.
Rise of the Indian Rope Trick. But when you finished the research, when you got into the writing, I'm curious what happened to you in the course of this book. I mean, there's a lot, because when you do a book, you like immerse yourself like an actor in a character.
Yes.
Right?
Very much. It's complete immersion. I'm completely buried in a character, in a period, in an historical phase that I thought I was fairly well versed about, as a reasonably well-educated person. The more I research this book, the more I research Hanussen, the more I research this era, the more I realize I was pretty ignorant. I didn't know the extent of the street fighting in the early 30s between the Nazis and the communists and the socialists, and a number of these were quite fatal. I didn't know the allure of the occult in Germany at this period, and we've spoken about that. I didn't know about these other Jews that, to a very considerable degree, helped the Nazis. And I also realized that this book, because it's dealing with this era in a way that I believe no other book has, through the prism of a man named Erich Jan Hanussen, a Jewish man who assisted the Nazis, a Jewish man who claimed to have all kinds of occult and psychic powers. It will attract people, hopefully, if all goes right, who wouldn't ordinarily read about Europe in the early 30s, Germany in the early 30s. I hope this will be an eye-opener for them. This will be an opportunity for them, too, to discover a Germany that I was not accustomed to, a Germany that I did not fully comprehend. I didn't know all the infighting between the Nazis. I didn't know, for example, that Ernst Röhm, who was the head of the stormtroopers for the entire country, was homosexual.
Well, they have the great cartoon in here. Little short, fat man lining up against a group of men, all who had their naked butts out, right?
Right. And he's reaching over and he is goosing them. And I don't know if that's the way, you know, the term goose-stepping came about. And even more of a surprise that Röhm was gay was that Hitler, to some extent, even defended Röhm's homosexuality. Certain confidants of Hitler would come up to him and warn him that Röhm was gay. People are saying at certain cafes in Berlin that not only was the head of the stormtroopers gay, but you, mein Führer, you may be gay also. And Of course, Hitler denied that, but he also said he didn't care what Rome was doing, what the stormtroopers were doing in their spare time, as long as they were good stormtroopers on duty. And I believe that might be the origins, Mark, of the don't ask, don't tell policy.
What? A couple of things before. That's wild. It's Adolf Hitler, the origin of the don't ask, don't tell. have mercy. A couple of things, though, that to get to for them. One thing is the powerful historical moment of the Reichstag fire. Mm. That we all people, you know, everybody hears. Most people have heard Reichstag fire or Reichstag. Mm. You go to school, you hear it for a second. They don't think about it, but it's there. But you don't really understand. People think, oh, the Nazis did it. People think that. That the communists or the socialists burnt down the German parliament, and gave Hitler the rise that he. Right. But you came up with something very different.
I came up with something very different, Mark. Yes, the Reichstag fire was just about a month after Hitler became the chancellor. He became chancellor January 30th, 1933. This is the parliament building in Berlin. As soon as Hitler heard that the building was on fire, he, Goebbels, Goering, all say it's caused by the communists. They went racing to the building itself, in fact. Hitler conferred with a British journalist whom he knew for quite a while and said, oh, yes, this is the work of the communists. And nothing could be better for the Nazis than to have a communist-caused fire, because that gave them the opportunity to fully clamp down on the country. The next day, all civil liberties were lifted in Germany. They were not restored until 1945. And most historians conclude that, yes, the Nazis did this, so they would have an opportunity to blame the communists. I have lots of conflicting evidence that perhaps even the communists did this. And I have lots of evidence that the communists who had been in Berlin, who then sought refuge in Paris and wrote a large book blaming the Nazis, were completely fabricating their evidence. So I think this is one of the great unsolved mysteries.
Well, story that occurred, there's one Nazi who might have gone into that himself, who was an arsonist.
That's right. Yeah, there was this underground tunnel that led between Goebbels' mansion and the Reichstag itself. Perhaps this crazed Dutchman, who was generally blamed for the fire, was followed by some Nazis, and they set the fire as well as this other man. So there's so many strands to this story. I walked away, and I will admit in the book, not knowing who caused the fire, but it certainly changed history.
One of the things, a couple of things quickly in the last few minutes we have that struck me. One was that as you write about the period of time, and that the Nazis at some point were down to just 12 seats in parliament, that nobody cared about Hitler. They mocked him. They thought he was nothing. Yeah. But then with the combination of the power, the money of the rich industrialists pushing him back up, and these other events that exploded, he came to power, this right-wing Nazi fascist maniac.
Yes.
How simple it was in some ways.
In some ways, yes, simple. And if you go back just a few months, middle of 32, you know, Hitler was basically down, almost out, 12% of the vote. How could he ever recover from that? And yet, yes, with the assistance of the industrialists, with the moneyed classes, he rose and rose and rose. He was very clever, very, very smart. And also, to get back to my main man, yes, with the assistance of Erich von Hannesen cheering him on in his own newspapers. And to bring this up to the present, and I'm going to read from the final paragraph of book, if I may. And earlier I was saying that I learned about Hannesen from this book, The Rise of the Indian Rope Trick. I was reading it very late at night. I say in the last paragraph, you know, late night reading of a book I accidentally picked up in a bookstore culminated in a journey on which I encountered wonderful people. the Germans I met today, and odd and peculiar ideas, all this nonsense about the occult. I also encountered historical figures who forced me to ponder our potentially fatal vanities. And it's that phrase, our potentially fatal vanities, I think certainly resonates with our time today. Look what's happening politically 24 hours a day. Look at what we are hearing from numerous candidates for numerous offices. Look at how sometimes we too easily succumb to their vanities. I think as citizens today, we have to be constantly on the alert for people who are attempting to prey on our weaknesses, on our tendencies, for the easiest answer, an answer which may put us into a situation not identical to what happened in early Nazi Germany, but certainly a situation that compromises us as a nation and as individuals. I think there are always people who are saying they have the answers. We have to be, as a nation, as people, very, very skeptical and very, very cynical. One of Honnesson's great failings was that he was not cynical, he was not skeptical, and he presented himself in a manner that he should not have. People believed him. We have to be very careful about who we believe today.
He had a great deal of power, more than he realized, I think, maybe. Yeah. Art, this is great to see you once again. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you, Mark.
Arthur Magida, M-A-G-I-D-A, by the way, wrote the book The Nazi Seance, A Strange Story of the Jewish Psychic in Hitler's Circle, the story of Erich John Honnesson, who was this performer, occult figure, got close to the Nazis, was a very powerful figure in Germany, met his own demise at the hand of the Nazis. And it's an amazing story, and I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mark. As usual, it was a pleasure.
It's always great. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. To podcast the Mark Steiner Show, share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org, or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. If you're a source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Have a great weekend. Take care.